whole international news, what's been saying, covering, talking about Kim and Kim's daughter, sister. None of them talking about people of North Korea, what their life is going on even right now.
Hi and welcome back everybody to another episode of the CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series podcast. My name is Sam Jackson Reed and I'm your host, and I'm joined also by my co-host.
It's Kiri Kankwende here.
You may be confused to hear my voice and not the wonderful lilting American tones of Darren Adwalpoca. He is taking a much deserved sabbatical and I'm jumping in to cover for this next little season. I'm the digital communications coordinator for CSW. And Kiri, why don't you just remind us what you do with CSW as well?
Yep. So I'm the external affairs team leader, managing CSW's outreach to international institutions and the media.
So Kiri is my boss in many ways. This is a good dynamic. But yeah, we're kicking off a new series this week, Kiri, aren't we? We're looking and beginning to moving on from Sudan, which we've just spent the last six or so weeks diving into. We really hope that everyone enjoyed that. Enjoyed is an interesting word, but found it interesting and found it compelling and learned a lot. And we're still opening up for people to ask questions if they have any questions off the back of that series. So please do get in touch with us. And we're looking to do an episode sort of just answering listener questions if you have them. But we're moving forward. We're moving on and looking at North Korea. But there's a particular reason, there's a particular date, isn't there, coming up that we're wanting to kind of tag this into.
Yes, so this week is a special day. It's Save North Korean Refugees Day, which is a day to focus on the many thousands of North Koreans that have fled the repressive regime of Kim Jong-un. Recent estimates are that at least 33,000 North Koreans have fled some of the most severe human rights violations that have been documented in North Korea, often into China, and then from there, hopefully making passage to another country where they can be safe, often South Korea.
Yeah, and this podcast is all about drawing out the human story and the reality on the ground and some of the history of some of the nations and the conflicts and the spaces that we work on. So we're really privileged for this episode to have interviewed Timothy Cho. Timothy Cho is a North Korean human rights activist, and he's a two-time defector from North Korea, and was imprisoned four times in North Korea and in China, but managed to escape. You'll hear in the coming episode that his parents fled North Korea during a period of famine that was known as the Arduous March, and basically left him as a homeless young boy. But he tried to follow them, aged 17, escaping into China before being forcibly repatriated into North Korea, which is something that happens almost every time. If you're found in China, they're going to repatriate you and send you back to North Korea. But he managed to escape again and is now based and settled in the UK and works as a human rights activist. So we're really privileged to have him come and speak to myself and to David Simpson, who is our North Korean advocate. So what you're about to hear in this episode is our conversation with Timothy Cho. He tells us his story, which is a famous story. He's told it in many, many, many places, but there were more sort of details about some of his early life. Had you heard his story before, Kiri?
Oh, yes. In fact, a few weeks before I'd heard his story at another event. He is very courageous in that he continues to share his arduous journey out of North Korea and into safety. But what I hadn't heard before is actually his memories of being in North Korea, his family, his childhood growing up there. And it was incredibly moving and a reminder that even though, as Timothy himself says, North Korean culture is sealed off from the outside world to a large extent, that inside ordinary families are, you know, trying to get on with their lives as best they can, trying to raise their children, trying to get their jobs done, trying to survive and dream of something better.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and we're really privileged to have him tell it to us. And we hope that you find it interesting, There are some heavy moments, but they are powerful moments. So without further ado, I'll pass this over to my past self and our North Korean advocate, David Simpson and Timothy Cho. Timothy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a real honor and a privilege to get to have a conversation with you. Would you mind just kind of introducing yourself? Maybe people might not know who you are. Just yeah, give it a bit of a sense of who you are, what you're up to, and that sort of thing.
My name is Timothy Cho, and I'm a North Korean escapee. I've been living in the UK for over 16 years now. I escaped North Korea twice, and I was unfortunately imprisoned on several occasions during my journey in China and North Korea. So I am now people call me a human rights activist, and I work as the Secretariat for the UK All Party Parliamentary Group on North Korea. So thank you for having me in this room today.
Thanks for joining us. You've shared widely about your dramatic escapes from North Korea. But could you tell us a little bit more about what your day-to-day life was like in North Korea, maybe particularly as a child and growing up? Are there any childhood memories, things about your family or jobs, those sorts of details? What was it like growing up in North Korea?
I thought as more time and year goes by year, you may forget your past memories because it's been, I think, approaching nearly 2 decades since I escaped this country. As I was speaking at a Christian conference a couple of weeks ago in London, and I did mention that. My life has been outside North Korea more than half of time is now passing. But I think more and more my memory actually going back to North Korea, what happened, particularly as a father today, when I spend time with my children, sometimes they raise these questions that why we were born in the UK and you were born, far away from this country, indicating a map. And even one time, my daughter and I were attending church service, and all of a sudden she asked me this question, "Daddy, what happened if you have church service in North Korea like this?" And it shocked me actually. And things what my children having here growing up that I could not have it. So actually having your own children and seeing how they are growing up on each day, this reflection come to me, it keeps on memory go back and comparing it, what life I had in North Korea. And even this morning, I've been interviewed by Christian Solidarity Worldwide. Did I ever expect that moment to come today? So from time to time, again and again, I reflect and I remind myself where I am and who I am, where I live today, what kind of work I am doing. And it is kind of a dream. And something that I have to pinch myself to realize to go back to where I am. And you can imagine North Korea, of course, you haven't been to North Korea, and maybe one day you can try, but they wouldn't be happy if you interviewed me before you come to North Korea. Lots of international spotlight, what's been going on, standing Putin and Xi Jinping and Kim there, we what we call axis of dictators. And yet, the whole international news, what's been saying, covering, talking about Kim and Kim's daughter, sister, none of them talking about people of North Korea, what their life is going on even right now. And certainly, if you ask me specifically, my life in North Korea, I could go back like it was normal. Day until I spent time with my parents, especially my parents who were high school teachers, and you're going to nursery, and and spending time with kids, but learn about how to speak and act and think as the kings of the typical brainwashing education, which I didn't realize. But they were, even from time to time, I still go on YouTube typing, see if there are that North Korean cartoons, actually on YouTube. There are actually, and which, when I was first primary school, and I waited to come home watching that cartoon. Eventually, and you realize today, all these cartoons were also about propaganda. And everything is centric of the Kim and Kim family. But this is all we had in North Korea, playing friends outside. Of course, they were not phones. And even until today, North Korea is the only country who you can have mobile phones, social media, Zoom, or any technology can imagine what we have today. And not phones there. TV was the TV we had. I think it was a black and white TV we had, and radio we had, and of course you can imagine the olden days. The listening to music equipment is massive, and my dad particularly, he was a history teacher. He loved the music, and also all music. I mean, what we know so far is about the Kim family praising music. So it's like. It's hard to grasp even, I experienced my life there. How the whole country itself completely sealed, centralized, listening to Kim, singing for the Kim, and from early day, morning till evening, thinking of Kim and context of the Kim. Yeah, it's hard to grasp. And the country then completely sealed, obviously. We will go into more specific, I'm sure you will ask more questions. This was a kind of my daily life. But after my parents escaped, but and the there was something different part of reality came to me was that, of course, I no longer had parents. And this part was challenging, then you have to survive. And the famine started already when even my parents were there. So both of my parents were school teachers, but my mom had to quit her job because someone had to do economic activities. So my mom quit her math teaching job, and what she did, and she traveled back and forth between north and south, bring some commodities that northern part of the area didn't have it, and she brought them, and then the something that we had in the northern part of the area, the city life didn't have it. So she did that trading, and often and went away, come home like after 2 weeks. So my father had to continue go to school teaching children, and there was obviously he didn't expect any salary, something like that. Perhaps now I hear from the recent defectors they have introduced some kind of salary system, but the salary still is very, very minimum. I mean, I think you can only have 1 meal of a family. That's it. That's done. But however, because my father was a teacher and some of his school classroom students' families who were bringing kind of some amount of vegetables, potatoes in thank and express their thanks to my father to teaching and their children. So this was a kind of substantial food, or otherwise my mother continued to provide it until they eventually and completely disappeared, escaped to China. And yeah, the reality was it was a hard, as you could see many children and died of starvation throughout the 1990s, and many people died of starvation. And it was people who completely relied on obviously the central distribution systems, And the first line of many North Koreans died of the starvation. Once they die, and these millions have died of it, but remaining people realized North Korea is no longer what it country used to be, and functioning central distribution systems. People started cutting trees in mountains or wherever they the piece of land available. They created allotments growing vegetables, potatoes, food, wherever it is available. So that actually what people kept on surviving since then. But what we see today, because of that, and we now have environmental issues massively facing in North Korea because they cut all trees and creating allotments and continue growing food in mountains. Now that changes the climate and environmental issues of a flood, rain, and storm. So, this is the one part I have always been emphasizing. International aid or the UN humanitarian systems and sending them food, that is only for short-term aid. However, if we approach what kind of seed and agricultural collaboration or support, I mean, they don't even have equipment in North Korea. And when I was helping my grandmother's farm, and my uncle and I did the farm, but we didn't have any equipment. So either my uncle and I became a cow. You know, we put in the what is it, the how you dig into the lane of the your farm, but man has to become a cow itself. So you make the line and put him seed inside, and they have no fertilizers. And I remember one of the interview questions I had a while ago, someone asked me, so there is no any, you know, the even waste available in North Korea. People from our people in outside, they might get confused with these questions. What do you mean, no waste in North Korea? But obviously, North Korea people collecting that human waste, and in wintertime they keep them in certain storeroom. But that is also being forced to give to national farm. So the private farms, individuals have to do that. And summertime, when it needs, they boil them. You know, they're holding in their backpack and take it to their farm. How that's what they are fertilizers. So it's very primitive society, and even what happened 20 years ago today, it remains very primitive, except for those North Korea investing in Pyongyang or tourist place recently opened, and because they need that money from international tourists. That's why some of the travelers went to North Korea. Oh, I could not spend North Korean currency. They only had to spend US dollars, you know, and that's what they need. And we'll have to see whether in the coming years, this pattern of what we so-called very primitive of life that may can change or reform may happen through what North Korea and tightening relationship with Russia and China. But regime survival is the main priority, still remains.
So, how old were you when you were working on your on the farm, and when your parents disappeared, when they escaped?
So, a few years I survived on the street, and I went back to my grandma, starting and helping her with growing food. It was 13, 14, 15. By the time when I was finishing high school age in North Korea, my height was 148 centimeter. And by then, also North Korea decreased the requirement of boys joining the army. From 145 centimeter, you could join the army because the lack of nutrition in North Korea across the country for decades. Those growing up generations are very short. I mean, imagine 145 centimeter and 37 kg, you have to join the army. And because of that, North Korea probably even reduced the weapon size. Otherwise, if you're holding the weapon, that might drag the on the floor. And so there are no way you can have I mean, good nutritions and eating meat. I think this was very special once, if I remember it correctly. We might have it two or three times a year. That was the only time you could eat meat. Or sometimes you buy 1 kg of pork, and but you have to give them like 10 or 15 kg of sweet corns. Because the main food in North Korea, not white rice, it's very expensive. People usually eat corn, and they even cultivate corn and grow. And the corn is not also specifically then and worked out. To produce corn rice itself, some of them just to make powder, and the powder goes in, and more vegetables going in, so make a soup. Well, and recent SKP said, oh, it was not what it used to be, and during the starvation time. But we then also realized the pandemic came in 2020. It's how many years? It's been 5 years. And since the pandemic and North Korea, there have been lack of resources. When you have lack of production from farm side, of course, North Korean agricultural production is limited. But then the marketplace, you need to have those items, commodities to exchange one another. Even you have black markets without enough commodities to exchange and buy transactions, that is going to be difficult. So, they only recently opened the Pyongyang to tourists, and now they even have just opened the new tourist places. All while Kim Jong-un said also the in return of sending tens of thousands of troops and to Russia in return and in part of deals also some agricultural collaboration between China and Russia and North Korea. So we will see how this might be and produce more, cultivate more agricultural production so that can and going on the market in North Korea. But so far, it is early stage to predict. In the meantime, of course, there is so much focus on military investment in it and collaboration and standing against Western democracy.
Tim, you've spoken a little bit how in your early childhood days there was an environment that inculcated extreme loyalty towards the Kim family. Everything from music, school education, everything was geared towards forming you to be somebody that was loyal to the Kim family and the Kim dynasty. You shared a little bit how the famine was a factor in sort of breaking the ceiling on that. Could you share a little bit more about what things did you see and what happened that started to erode that how the propaganda had formed you to see them as the sole providers in your life? And then additionally to that, what sort of environment like that, and how did it affect your relationships with others? How did that affect your relationships with classmates, with your neighbors, with family members, and especially after your parents had left as the son of escapees, how did that affect your ability to form bonds with people in the context of the pressure on reporting anti-government sentiment and illegal behavior? So the two questions there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I go back to first year of primary school, and one of a group of us, our teacher asked us to visit one of our friend, and he didn't come to school, and so we went, and as five of us, we went to our friend's house and knock on the door. Knock on the door, and there was no one opening the door. The door was a few centimeters was there was space and opened, and we could see inside the house. And we were shocked because whole family were lying down on the floor, and they were all the faces, eyes, arms, whole body was very seriously swollen off. You couldn't even barely recognize who they were. You couldn't see their eyes properly. And they ate what was the grass, because they, if you ask most of northern escapees, take them to the field or mountains, you ask them what is edible, what is not edible. Most of them, they could pick them up and tell us what is edible, what is healthy, what is kind of, herb medical treatment. And because we survived of these nature of productions available in North Korea. But this family, they ate and this collected grass from the field. But I think it was something they did not soak in the water properly. So poison still contained it. And this was the first experience we remember. We were just the first year of primary school. And so when we reported to our teacher, and teacher asked all of us if we could donate something to give this family so we can bring our friend back to school. I think it was quite scary. Yeah. I remember it was really scary to me actually. So I went to home and told my parents, and my father said, oh, one of the children, that house was my father's student actually, and my mom and gave me 10 kg of potatoes, and so I took it with me to the school, and other classmates, they brought a portion of rice powder or whatever was available, so we actually made a couple of sacks of food and took them to our friend's house. So in 2 days' time, he was able to come back to school. But that was the beginning of it. And that was the beginning of it. And more people started dying of starvation, and people started to escape. Yeah, it was a while ago. I think this experience of trauma, which remains every dining table, I ask my kids to pray for what we are able to eat. Or even my wife sometimes say, we don't have a very a big house or a very nice car. But I kept on saying, I still say to her, we have enough food on our dining table. And so that was the first experience. And what the reason I'm saying this, we were taught and we were brainwashed, as long as the Kim family lives, God figure, and we shouldn't be worried. And how I believed, how my perception or other same, everything was centric of the Kim, we would have been okay as long as he was there, the family was there. But this was a reality check. So I am going to be 37 this year, if my age. Then thinking about my generation, go back to first level primary school, and I could be the same generation as the Kim Jong-un. So these now growing up generations, 20s, 30s, and soon they reach 40s, imagine what kind of loyalty they might have. So there is a reality check, and where it's being forced to give your life to the country and nation. And so some escapees said to me, who I met in South Korea when they first crossed the border to China, when Chinese people mentioned Kim Jong Il, Kim Il-sung, without the general, marshal, some kind of the title, they said they were not happy hearing that. They were not respecting Kims, but they were my parent generations more likely. So this is a very interesting point. So the grievance and also the reality check and forced coercion of that you give, submit your life, devotion, everything to the king, I think this can be separated, and we even among elite, I think this is the between fact check and this the royal and royalty to the kings and the state, I think this certainly can be distinguished. But my parent generation or grandparent generation remains still there in North Korea, especially Kim Jong-un, surrounded by his father's generation, and who continue to keep him and uphold him as the legacy of the Kim. And so that picture, let's then move on to the other picture of after my parents escaped. Before my parents escaped, I believed the Kim was my God. And I do remember that day when first Kim died. A whole school was in tears of, and the news was kept on saying the entire nation and world is sad. Even the sky was sad. It was raining season, obviously. But be
Just to clarify, Tim, sorry, this is Kim Il-sung when Kim Il-sung died.
that's right. Yes, Kim Il-sung. And whole that week, I didn't smile, and I cried, and I even went to mountain, going around to try to collect flowers from mountains, and all flowers was already gone, whether there was other loyalty from other people, and so same to me, and it was extremely sad, scared. I thought the world going to collapse because my God died. When I spoke to my dad, well, certainly at some point, my dad was royal and communism or Kim family as he was in the line of education, and he was kept on brainwashing the kids and produce and reproduce of these brainwashed children. So when I asked my father, "We're all gonna die because our God died," and my father's reaction was so funny. If I think of it now, he was holding tears in his eyes. "No, son, he's not died. He lives in our heart. He's our eternal leader. He lives forever, and we now follow his son Kim Jong Il," and I even it's my own experience of it. How, the power of what kind of society, how you grew up, what kind of truth denied. This is a significant part of that education then conveyed into generation and generation. And this is what North Korea has been there and becomes and still goes. But obviously then to support this information blockade is the number one sources. Without that, they cannot continue carry out this society. So when you look at inside North Korea, where Kim Jong-un, every new year he goes to bow to his father and grandfather, where they are kept their bodies in glass containers. They're not buried. They still look like they are sleeping, which exactly they do the same way what Stalin did or Mao did. It's not God. And it's a man who died when back to where he come from, where they come from, but they kept it like the way make mythical and brainwashing idolize in this way. And that's my lo what I how I could have been part of this. And now after my parents left, and I remember I went back to school one day, and my teacher, who was a good friend of my both parents because they were both teachers in the same school, and they she told me, "Timothy, did you know that you no longer your name is no longer in the classroom?" And I was shocked. And then and some of my friends were fingering at me, "Oh, his father betrayed this country because he was a teacher in the school, and he was one of the first few people escaped to China." This taboo was extreme kind of the culture of betrayers, betray the leader, and this was all coming to me, and that's why I couldn't go to school anymore. And it was a small town where I grew up in northern parts of North Korea, about 10,000 people population. So everybody knew who my father was. If someone come from that area, if they don't know who my father was, we call them a spy, actually. So this was the difficult part. And later and following with this, I was learning about what's the system, the socio-political classification system in North Korea. And I still also didn't know until I went to military office that I couldn't even join the army in North Korea. So my disloyalty, all understanding and learning the reality of the society systems, when it came to rejected me, when I tried to give everything and rejected me again and again. And so this part, when I come to China, and I don't know exactly since when my heart was no longer for the Kim society. Maybe it already started when I first saw that my friend was dying of starvation, or so seeing kids died of starvation on the street, or when I went back to school after my father escaped, the fingering at me and whispering, "Oh, he's a son of traitors." And then come to military office when they told me, "You cannot join the army because your father betrayed this country." That doesn't mean son betrayed the country. I think it was automatically my heart was understanding, realizing the truth of this society, and it was then already. And I don't know exactly, but I didn't feel anything when even people said fingering us, and Chinese people said Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, without a specific title. I wasn't bothered at all. Maybe I have seen a lot.
How much of that do you feel then fed into the decision for yourself to try and escape?
When I was living my grandmother, I think I was about 16. In my village, there were brokers. In my town, there were brokers. We know in general perception of brokers and who crossed the border between North Korea and China. And they were bribing soldiers. They were bringing North Chinese items into North Korea and selling it, or they were taking some of those valuable items they could sell in China. And I remember this guy, he died, and I heard the news later. He died after I escaped. And he told me, "I think your father is in China. Why you still live in North Korea?" He actually one or twice mentioned that you should go to China. And I told him, "Don't even mention that my father betrayed the country. I wouldn't betray it." So I never thought, although I was slowly, step, gradually, my loyalty was falling apart from the regime. But still, my heart was not actually desire or willing to leave the country, because I loved North Korea and I loved the people, the beautiful people. I still love them. And even last night, I was sharing us reading a story for my daughter. And there was a story actually from Korea in that book, and how North Korean people and warm hospitality provide strangers, food and accommodation. My daughter said, "Daddy, would it not be scary if provide food and allow a stranger to come stay in our house?" And so this was the part, and I never thought I was leaving North Korea. But when I realized At the moment, North Korea told me to go to coal mine. So when I couldn't join the army, and the officer told me, and go to coal mine. And this is a specific unit group they composed by families of social classification systems, the enemy class. So they usually being sent the first very dangerous line of the coal mines. And we know North Korea is very dark when you see through Google satellite. It's because they have lack of electricity, but because they cannot also produce enough coal to work the power stations. And they have plenty of coals, but they don't have enough technology. They often use either manpower going in or where the minimum amount of coal they can dig out. So this mine, you have to crawl into the cave. You can't even stand up, and you dig the coals out. But often the mines are collapsed and amputated, young men and women's arms, legs, or some of them killed. And when they told me, my teacher told me, we will organize you to go to the coal mine. Then you don't have to worry. They will provide you with food and everything. Once you complete that few years serving the coal mine, the nation may give you something, they provide you with some kind of job, or maybe they even provide you with a wife. That's what he said to me. And so that determined to escape to China. I still didn't know what was going on outside North Korea. So far, you watch the South Korean drama films, but that was not enough to understand what outside looked like. Of course, now it's much better. And since I escaped, there'll be more and smuggled items poured into North Korea, and many people being watched, and some of them just escaped because of the information and free outside available. And that's how I crossed the border to China, I remember it. And I cried. It took me half an hour to cross the border to China and with the four people, and arrived in China, and I'm standing at the border, look at standing there and seeing where my homeland was. It teared me. And I never thought I was leaving my hometown country. Well, country, definitely Korea, but not Kim's country I would support, thought about. But life was in China something very different. It was still, go back to like 17, 18 years, China was still less developed. But it was enough. They no longer had a story of starvation. Plenty of food, open culture, young people were wearing different clothes. And obviously, now with under Xi Jinping, the system a lot is more restricted and oppressed, persecuted today than perhaps that time was less level of that. And first time seeing young people wearing different clothes, that was really shocking. And I remember one time in North Korea, I worked so hard, and my grandmother really liked me, so she one time asked me, "What is your wish? I want to buy something for you." And so I told her, "I want to wear a cloth, have elephant on raincoat, the jacket. It protected rain, but it had a specific couple of elephants, on my on the jacket. But also they were written some of English words." So my grandmother actually bought it from a broker who brought it from China, and because I worked so hard. But then grandmother said all night on the candlelight she was taking off the English character words on the cloth, because you cannot have any English written words on your jacket, jumper, anything. And so this was my favorite jacket I ever had in North Korea. And though there were plenty of these jackets when I first entered the Chinese market, young people wearing it, and shoes and hairstyles. If you live to, the uniform society, just wearing same red tie, jacket and shirt, shoes, and only one hairstyle. I mean, you can imagine all of a sudden you see a different world. Wow, this kind of a world we have in this world. And this was my first impression, and shocking to see the life in China. And I think what one of the reasons why I continue to speak out, particularly telling the story, even though my story comes from decades ago, and also telling the story today, is that as a human rights activist, this is the part where Kim Jong-un is not fighting so hard. That culture, what I saw, and some percent of this culture of freedom of expression, it has entered in North Korea. It gone to around the North Korea, and this is why North Korea is so much persecuting young people, the language they use, what kind of clothes they wear, and how they gesturing or listening to K-pop, K-drama. They send them labor camp or even execute them. Once that culture entered across the border into that dark place, you can't stop it. And I was the generation of tasting it, and now more and more going into, and my generation now have even children, same as in North Korea. And the revolutionary movement has already started in North Korea. It's just a matter of time. And the other shocking experience I had in China was that meeting Christian missionary. And I was lucky I met this missionary guy. So during those early 2000s, number of missionaries, they came to North Korean border, and they knew, they could see when North Korean, particularly those kids or orphans, they cross the border into China. You can see what they look like, miserable, quite thin, and looked like in malnutrition. And so when I met this missionary guy, he simply said to me he wanted to help me. So entering his house, and the first thing I saw, there was the cross and on the wall, well, small table, and the Bible was there, the cross was there, and few orphan children in the house. And I thought he was human kidnapper and kidnapping North Korean children and sell them into human trafficking, or even take their blood and organs out. But what more shocked me was that the Bible and cross, I thought it was the curse. It was the curse. You touching them, your finger would be rotten right away because it was the curse. In North Korea, religious persecution is on top of the world rank. Not just Christians, but and even those who practice shamanism, they were being sent to labor camp and sentenced a few years, or certain cases they are also executed. However, the most tangible and punished religion in North Korea is Christians, because the fundamentality is Christians is love. And Kim's definition, from young age we learned love is come from the Kim family. So they would definitely put this distinguish and not allow any Christians in gospel, the message of God, to come to spread around the country. And therefore, from young age, getting this anti-Christian and education, this was kind of demonic culture in North Korea. It was a kind of demonic culture. And they said in drama, school textbook, cartoons, and a musical, how missionaries are using that cross and come to killing, kidnapping, raping, did bad things. Yeah, I would never forget that. And I did believe, the cross was a real curse. And it's strange today how the cross is in my heart as a Christian myself. And I remember I was crying and crying when I first knelt to God in Shanghai prison. I don't know where that tears came from, or asking God to forgive me that I denied him because I didn't know. Can you imagine how many millions of North Koreans, they don't know God itself? It's an opportunity they cannot find out. That makes me feel really, really sad. And I escaped from the safe house because I believed he was a human trafficker and bad thing would come to me. And I ran away from the Christian missionary's house, but didn't realize he wanted to just help me, which was lucky. If you met missionary, they would help you to get out of China safely. That's how my journey ended up, and arrested at the Mongolian border. And we were 18 of us. We were sent back to North Korea.
That's the end of part one of our conversation with Timothy Cho. Join us next week for part two and to hear the rest of his courageous story, how he escaped North Korea once again and made his way into China and eventually settled in the UK. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening to the CSW Free to Believe podcast. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. Our work, including this podcast, exists because of the generosity of our supporters, just like you. If you're interested in finding out more or making a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can help us grow this work and help it become a resource, highlighting and amplifying the voices of those who suffer as a result of their religion or belief by sharing it with your friends or by leaving a 5-star review in whichever podcast catcher you're currently listening to.